Hey guys.
Hey.
We are live and also simultaneously recording an audio podcast for the Vaccine Conversation.
Yeah.
In my new library.
I know. I feel like this is very sophisticated, Melissa.
It's very sophisticated.
When you're in library.
That's because we're all about
see all the books.
Research.
She's read every one of these.
Every one of those books I've read, guys.
When she's done researching, she puts the book up here and the bookcase is full, as you can see, as is her mind, I
right.
guess. Is it full yet?
As is my plate of problems.
Yes.
So Dr. Bob came over so that we could record a new episode for the Vaccine Conversation, and I had the bright idea.
To talk into the microphone.
I had the bright idea of setting this up for you guys so that you could sort of see us doing this. Now, we're not going to obviously do this every time, and he hates it. But I know a lot of you guys like the video. So I was going to do this on IG, but you have to stay vertical, and it was just too hard to see everything in this interesting setup that I have here in my garage. So anyway, we have an interesting episode today that focuses on...
Yeah. the COVID vaccine.
Talking about the coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, and several different aspects of the vaccine. One of our focus is one article from the New England Journal of Medicine that was just published that is kind of it's a roadmap on how to justify making the COVID vaccine mandatory.
In fact, the name of this article right here is called Ensuring Uptake of Vaccines Against SARS-CoV-2. So SARS-CoV-2 is the same thing as what people call coronavirus, COVID-19, that's the name of the actual virus, because the sister virus is SARS-CoV-1. So what's really funny about this is every time I hear somebody say something like, this is a new virus, they're learning about it. And so that's why they thought masks didn't work, but now they do. Or that's why they didn't realize how it spread. Mm-hmm. You know, I find it interesting that there is some point of reference for this. I mean, not just SARS-CoV-1, but the whole family of coronaviruses.
Right.
There's data. I mean, SARS-CoV-1 is from 2003. That's 17 years worth of data. And there were a lot of similar patterns with how it spread and who was affected.
Right.
So it's not like it's entirely new, just completely out of the ordinary.
Right. Although, did you see Fauci's Facebook rebuttal to that?
Yeah.
He's like, it's almost as if he's reading your post and he's talking to you. He's like,
what'd he say?
Come on, guys. This is a brand new coronavirus. That's what the word novel means. We know nothing about it. We're learning everything we need to learn. It's brand new. We don't know what to do about it or how to approach it. And so he kind of tried to shut down that general idea.
I mean, I don't really buy that because, like I said, there's a sister virus here that they have 17 years worth of data on. And somebody like Fauci has been studying infectious disease for decades. Like, the truth is there's really not that much variation between these viruses. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
It's really, I mean, the difference could be the length of incubation period or exactly how contagious with the R-naught levels, or does it transfer from the nasal passageways or from respiratory drops or coughing or lung to, you know, there are specific details, but for the most part, like the epidemiology of virus outbreaks and how it works and how it transfers through a population tends to be really similar. And I've seen that with all of the epidemiology I've been looking at in the last several months, because that's obviously not my particular field, but I've been looking at experts who do that, and you see a lot of similarities. So I feel like there was so much we could predict. There was so much that we did know about this. Like, even SARS-CoV-1 in 2003 had a much higher mortality rate. That was like 9 to 10%, which is extremely high. When we're looking at this as 0.2 or 0.1.
Yeah.
So 9 to 10% is extremely high. But it did not affect children either. So, you know, a characteristic like that is very unique, we had that in the database.
Yeah.
And then when we saw all those patterns repeating, the fact that they're still 6-7 months later trying to say, we don't know if this affects children, I think is ridiculous, because we have all these countries' data to show us that no, it doesn't affect children. And it's just like we thought in the data 17 years ago, which is that it doesn't really affect children.
Yeah.
So,
you know,
anyway.
What? We forgot to do the most important thing of our podcast.
The intro?
Yeah, I didn't welcome us in.
This is our intro banter.
Yeah.
Remember when we used to do that?
I know.
That was a
long
time
ago. In our old studio, it used to be all set up already. So, like, I would get there and Melissa would walk in, and I'd turn on the recorder and we just kind of, you know, hey, how's it going? You know, what's new?
And I started throwing out jokes, and he'd have his little drum set. But
yeah, that was our banter. Now it's
now we're just like, now it's me going, can we postpone? Can we reschedule to tomorrow? How about the next day? How about the next day? I'm tired.
Well, thank you for not doing this in your backyard today.
Yeah, it's
because
too hot.
It is freaking hot.
Yes.
It is, what, 85 degrees?
I haven't been outside.
I
avoid going outside.
When you open the door for somebody else.
Welcome in, everybody, to the Vaccine Conversation with Melissa and Dr. Bob.
This is episode what? 111?
Episode 111, maybe.
111, maybe? Nice.
Yeah,
look at us.
Okay, now where were we?
Just talking about important stuff.
All right.
So anyway, this article right here, again, is called Ensuring Uptake of Vaccines Against SARS-CoV-2. This was published, do you have the date? Oh, July 25th. Oh, no, it was downloaded July 25th. So it was published not that long before that, though, because this was a new article.
Yeah. And it was, it's not a research article. It's kind of basically like an informational piece, perspective. And it was written by people from Stanford Law and Stanford Health Policy and the Department of Medicine from Stanford University.
But why this was interesting, and I had sent this to Dr. Bob, but he had already read it a couple days prior, is this talks about how to get the public to comply with a mandated universal vaccine for everyone. Now, again, I think it's so interesting that somebody had to fund this, the time and effort they put into kind of gathering
Yeah.
The fact that they're spending money on how to influence the public about a vaccine that may come out 6 months to 12 months down the road for a virus that has a 99.5 plus recovery rate just doesn't make sense to me. We've seen the articles that say that the virus is actually moving so fast and kind of becoming mild so fast that it's going to be hard for them to create a vaccine. Have you seen some of these articles that saying it's moving so quickly, it's making it difficult for vaccine production? And so the fact that they're taking all this effort to put it into this is not a widespread, super deadly disease. The fact that they're doing all this, I find so interesting because they're already forecasting to the future of what they're going to need to do when most likely a big majority of the population would have already had this.
I know. And I even heard someone say a couple of months ago, we have to hurry up and get the vaccine out before everyone's got the
disease. Before herd immunity, right?
Right. And this is actually a multi-center approach to this article. It included Indiana University, and it includes Yale Institute for Global Health. And it's written by two of these are law professors. And one is a law professor and master's of public health, and another one is a master's of public health and a PhD, a doctorate in public health.
Well, so a lot of people think that our podcast or our work or our nonprofit is anti-vaccine. That's the label we get. That's the label Dr. Bob has gotten for a long time. Every time that you question something, you're anti-vaccine. But the truth of what we've always fought for is being against mandates. So this mandated medicine. So this article is directly discussing how to turn this into a medical mandate and basically how to have that discussion with the public and how to force people to do it. This is, the very first thing it says in here, it says, they're trying to get people to take the vaccine. And what they said was they have about 49% of Americans are thinking that they would like to get it. So that's not high enough for them.
It's kind of like the flu shot. Yeah.
Right, which is about 47%. So it says one way to get people to do it is to require it. See, is to require it. And it's funny that later on they go on to say that this is not to be confused with a compulsory vaccination program, even though it really is.
Right.
Because instead of what they consider forcing it, they're basically just halting your access to life if you choose not to comply.
Right.
And that's really the same thing, in my opinion, because some of the things that they're threatening to do is suspend your employment, not let your children go to school, things like that. So that keeps you from being able to earn a living and it keeps your child from being educated. That's the same thing as forcing it. This is compulsory. Like the fact that they're trying to make it look like, oh, no, we're just trying to increase the uptake. Let's just get everybody to join the team, you know, team vaccine. But but in reality, they really are trying to force it.
Yeah.
What did you think of this when you first read it?
Well, I was, you know, I was very concerned when I saw the title. But when I actually read through it, I thought it was actually pretty thoughtful, pretty interesting. And some of the points I agreed with and some of the points I did not agree with, actually. And then I actually felt like they left off the most important point for a mandatory vaccine or a compulsory vaccine, you know, however, you know, strong they want to get. They totally left out the fact that the disease should be really, 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 really bad. The disease should be serious.
Of course.
They totally left it out. They have six criteria that would justify mandating a vaccine, and they left out what to me would be the number one criterion for a mandate would be you have to have a really terrible disease that's, you know, spreading through the nation, killing everyone left and right. And I think that might be kind of partly why they looked at the mandate for smallpox vaccine, you know, so many years ago, is that's a pretty bad disease. And
that's also an arbitrary one. This is the thing that kind of frustrates me when people talk about this is, to me, COVID is not just arbitrary as far as who's going to get complications from it. It's arbitrary as far as everybody being exposed if it's you're contagious, just like anything else. But it's not like Ebola, which is just like everybody that gets it is going to have a very hard time with it.
Right.
This is something very, very narrowed as far as who's going to suffer. The people that kind of go, hey, you can be healthy in 35 and get this and die from it, it doesn't really work that way. I mean, the data does not support that argument.
Right.
In fact, influenza has a higher chance of causing serious complications in people under 50 than COVID does, from what I'm seeing.
Right. And yeah, and we've had
children.
Yeah, and we've had fewer, much, much fewer children pass away from COVID than we ever do during a flu season.
Right.
During one flu season. But yeah, I think what you're saying about the disease not being, what was it, arbitrary?
Right.
Whereas smallpox, we weren't around back then, but my understanding is it was a very arbitrary disease. Mm-hmm. You could be someone who's perfectly healthy and get struck by smallpox and die. Yeah, didn't kind of pick and choose.
And that's a different kind of thing than this, where your underlying health and your foundation for health can actually make a difference in whether or not you get through it okay or you end up having complications. The fact that they're even thinking of mandating something that really isn't arbitrarily causing complications to the general population is really scary, because to go to this type of length, to go to the length like I talked about on my sidecast about Bill Gates and the COVID vaccine and the idea that he wants to vaccinate 7 billion people, and this may be every year, and he wants it on the newborn schedule, that the length that he is going to and others are going to make it like we've got to get everybody to get this vaccine, as if this is like the most deadly virus we've ever encountered, is crazy to me, because the data does not support that. The data does not support the need for that. And we should look at mandating anything should be out of absolute necessity. Like, this is like, we don't want to have to do this, but this is the last thing we can. This is almost like, we don't really need to do this, but let's do it.
Doesn't it?
Crazy.
I know. So they have six, basically they say, we believe that six substantive criteria should be met before a state imposes a SARS-CoV-2 vaccine mandate. And they point out that this will be a state authority, a state law, and there are six criteria. And do you want to read
go
all
ahead.
Six real quick? Or
yeah,
just
sure,
go ahead. Yeah, so basically they say the virus is not adequately contained in that state. That number two, the ACIP, that's the committee that approves vaccines for the U.S., has recommended vaccination for the groups for which a mandate is being considered.
Okay, so before we move on, let's just quickly address these, because
we can go one at a time.
Yeah, because it's going to be harder to go back after six. Yeah, but just let's just even these two. The first one, that the virus is not under control. See, that's scary to me, because what are they using to define that? We're here in California, where schools cannot reopen until they meet a long list of criteria.
Right.
And that criteria includes cases in 14 days, not meeting a certain list within 14 days. Well, what if the criteria for this becomes no cases in, 2 weeks, no cases at all? But this is something that spreads through the community. And so there are going to be cases, and cases don't necessarily mean danger or risk. And so see, by putting that kind of thing in there, it's literally giving power to whoever decides what that criteria is. And that, and from my perspective, at least here in California, these lists that Gavin Newsom brings us, they're impossible to meet. You'll never meet the criteria to get off the list. And it is absolutely by design. It's by design that way. It's like they make it so difficult for you to even get off that list. So they make it seem like there's hope at the end of the tunnel, but you never get to the end of the tunnel. So my concern with this being the very first thing they're looking at, if the state can't control the virus, it's like, well, what does that mean? What does that look like? And it kind of means like that's going to be this very vague, open-ended thing. Well, oh, we couldn't control it. So therefore, we're going to have to institute mandatory COVID vaccines.
Yeah, and it'll be so weird to have this be different in every single state. To have different criteria on how they decide whether or not it's controlled, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's going to be centralized or not.
But the ACIP thing, too, the reason I stopped there is, you know, the ACIP recommends all sorts of vaccines for the childhood schedule. And they are not all things that are completely awful, fatal, super contagious diseases. There are things that they have put on the schedule, but they are not all necessary, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of experts. So the fact that the ACIP decides to put it on a schedule should not convince the public that this is so dangerous, because look, the ACIP added it. They also have things on there that I feel should be completely optional.
Right, right. But what I found interesting, I think something that I didn't agree with any mandate, but I agree with how they're kind of breaking it down, and that their second criteria is that they think the ACIP should mandate the vaccine at targeted populations, mm-hmm. targeted people at high risk of disease.
But you know what?
Start
you know
with
what
the
happens
mandate
though.
There.
They always do that. That's how everything has been
that's
added.
That's how it starts,
it
right?
It literally has always been, oh, for a high-risk group that's exposed, and all of a sudden it's, oh, and for every child.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, so let me clarify.
Adult.
Basically, they said the ACIP is going to recommend the vaccines to certain groups, like the elderly, health professionals, people working in, you know, the healthcare industry, maybe people with diabetes, people with chronic health conditions. The ACIP is probably going to mandate it or recommend it for everybody sort of overall as a general recommendation, mm-hmm. but then targeted recommendations for high-risk groups. And so these authors are suggesting that the mandate should focus primarily on those high-risk groups that the ACIP selects mm-hmm. as high-risk, and not necessarily a global mandate for everybody.
Well, the ACIP is U.S. too, so
right,
it can't
right.
really...
No, did I say global? Yeah, I guess.
But,
I mean global as a country, like... In that
they're,
you know, they think it's unlikely that they're going to mandate it for every single person in the entire country. They would probably start with targeted mandates. You're right.
I mean, this is what happened to the flu, right? At first, it's just healthcare workers and elderly, and then all of a sudden it becomes high risk.
But, I love going back to point number one, the authors kind of, they sort of contradict themselves because they say, quote, principles of public health law and ethics require that interventions that impinge on autonomy be reasonable and necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, public health law.
Right, public health law.
Right.
Right. So that's kind of their job, is to show how this is reasonable and necessary. And they feel like by the time we have a vaccine, we'll know a lot more about natural mm-hmm. immunity. We'll see what happens when we have relaxed the mitigating measures. We've got more, testing and contact tracing. They say there should be a reasonable indication as to whether mandating measures are needed by that time.
Well, you know, I think the thing that probably everybody's thinking as they hear this is very reminiscent of 2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Right?
They told us already, it's just going to be this. It's only going to be this. And it's going to be for everybody's protection. We can all get on board with that, right? And it seems reasonable. And it seems like a practical solution. And then you have stuff like this, where it's like, oh, only if it's necessary. And it's just all it takes is a couple change in words, especially if you still have governors making decisions, executive orders that are not, laws aren't being made with the legislature, but you're making these during this public, state of emergency, that it just takes a change of a couple of words to fit it into the whole. And this is worrisome enough for us, so we're going to go down this route. Even if you might say this doesn't seem ethical, this doesn't seem necessary, this seems like an overreach. They seem to have gone way above all of that from the very beginning and everybody trusted early on, I feel like the public's trust in our policymakers has definitely waned.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Big
because
time.
We... I didn't have that trust at the beginning, you as you know, because I...
Oh, neither did I. You guys remember that, right? Yeah, I was...
I didn't. I mean,
because... I was like, yeah, they don't know what they're talking about. You know,
like, what?
I can't believe you're going to shut us down for 2 weeks. There's no way.
You're like,
we're not going to stand for it.
Yeah, yeah. You're like sitting there telling me, like, Melissa, these are the leaders of our country, and this is what they're doing, and we might as well just go along with it because we can't change it. I remember you saying those exact words.
Yeah, but I didn't say those on the air.
No,
we did.
Not
we edited
now.
That out. So come
now
on.
It's live. So, but what I the reason I bring that up, that public trust issue, is, you know, I wonder if the number of people willing to get the vaccine voluntarily is even going to go down by the time that it's unveiled. Because
right.
It will be more time for people to not really trust this flip-flop policy that we're seeing in all of our states, mm-hmm. our leaders, and even on the federal level. Nobody knows who to trust anymore. But the other element is, from what I told you from the CDC's director, Robert Redfield. Every time I hear his name, I think of Robert Redford.
Yeah.
he's not nearly as attractive. Anyway, so Robert Redfield basically said that he is looking at a vaccine by January. Every vaccine that's in the running for this is going to be by January. Whether or not it's safe or effective, it's just, it needs to be by January. I'm a little nervous that to, you know, let's say potentially reopen schools with a mass vaccination program in January near the peak of flu season, there's going to be a lot of sick people, but
right.
they're not going to be sick with COVID. They're going to be sick with other respiratory viruses, mm-hmm. but the hospitals are going to be full. People are going to be seeing sick people everywhere. They're going to assume it's COVID. They're going to assume we have new waves of things like that. And it's going to all get lumped together into a group of fear and illness. And when that happens, I worry that coincidentally, they'll have the vaccine available right at that time, and people that are now scared again are going to want to get it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because of the timing.
Yeah. Yeah, and guess what? Everyone that they are testing the vaccine on right now, guess what vaccine they're not simultaneously getting right now during these COVID vaccine trials?
The flu shot.
The flu shot. So by the time they come out with the COVID vaccine, it's flu season. Now everyone's getting both shots in the same day,
mm-hmm.
a flu shot and a COVID shot, or maybe separated by a month or a few weeks. There's going to be zero research on simultaneous use of flu vaccine with COVID vaccine. They're not going to know, do they interfere with each other? Do they cause more side effects together? And does one vaccine make you more susceptible to the other disease,
well, right.
which you already know partly? So
yeah,
totally,
we've talked about that.
Yeah, they're totally going to be vaccinating our whole country during flu vaccine season, which I think I'm a little uncomfortable with.
And if they aren't going to reopen schools till January, it's like that's the worst possible time to put children together, because children actually do spread influenza. They're not the primary spreaders of coronavirus,
right.
but they do spread influenza. So there's just going to be a lot of sickness in general. And I'm afraid everybody with a scratchy throat, everybody with aches or whatever they're instantly going to go, oh my God, I've got coronavirus. They're going to probably go get tested. They might test positive because it's already in the population, but they'll be sent home to quarantine. Everybody in their class is going to have to quarantine.
This is
going to all get muddled together.
Right. It's all going to be flu.
Exactly.
Yeah. And how awesome was that for the CDC to publish a policy paper based on our podcast episode? How cool was that? The children should go back
to
school.
We're doing good work here. I posted about all the little bullet points on that CDC's article that kind of talks about all the reasons that kids should go back to school.
Yeah.
But if they don't do this until January, we're going to see a surge of the flu happening at the same time with flu vaccines, with a brand new, untested in the population vaccine for coronavirus. And I feel like it's going to take us into a downward spiral that's going to overwhelm hospitals and maybe go for a third lockdown.
Right.
It's going to be another way to keep everybody from having to close their businesses. I mean, I don't know how we survive this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, everybody's, including children, they're going to be more susceptible to illness because they've been inside for months now.
Yeah.
And so we're literally setting ourselves up, to me, in my mind, for like the worst possible situation. And I don't really know, just like some of those international experts had talked about, the exit strategy. There was never a real and clear exit strategy that allows us to get out of this at the best possible time. And when would be the best possible time? Summer?
Spring. Summer. Yeah.
When you don't have respiratory viruses spreading around like crazy, not peak flu season.
I know. And you warned us, you warned me that we don't have an exit strategy. And I think pretty much every policymaker, if you're going to go do something just like huge and crazy, whether it's going to war or whatever, you can never do that without an exit strategy. And you're totally right. We entered this lockdown without an exit strategy.
Well, that's what Sweden's lead epidemiologist said, that when they saw these Western countries going into lockdown, the first things they thought were, how do you get out of this? There's no way to positively get out of this, because anything that you do, now that you've closed everything, anything that you do is going to see a surge. Anything you can do is going to see the overwhelm. It's going to see the increase in fear. And instead of just attacking it head on and allowing it to be in the population, which, by the way, Sweden's graph, still going down. Have you been following it? Yeah. I mean, it is falling.
Especially their fatalities have just dropped down.
It is, and it's a traditional virus curve.
Right.
I mean, you look at it, and it's like literally the epitome of a virus curve. And everybody said this was the wrong way to go. They shouldn't have done it. And they went with what they said, evidence-based policy decisions.
Yeah.
They went with making sure we don't just do something and have to figure this out later, but that we do something based on evidence. The evidence showed them that children were not a risk, so they kept their schools open. The evidence showed them that the young and healthy should be exposed, so they allowed that. They had a lot of voluntary measures, but they didn't mandate masks. They didn't mandate the lockdown. They protected the elderly in the nursing homes, but they went with evidence, and everybody criticized them. Mm-hmm. And I think what we are going to see is probably their flu season is probably going to hit them less hard as well, because they would have handled this better. We're going to be in the middle of all of this, not just us, but a lot of other countries like the UK that did what we did. I'll be interested to see what the rest of Europe's doing. Asia seems to handle these pretty well, but we're going to have to look. I think this is going to be another year's worth of up and down drama, deaths, all of it. Yeah. And not so much because of the virus, but because of how they handled the virus. You know, we've talked about this. So, you know, this whole idea of like, let's create a mandatory vaccine program and get everybody, comfortable with this.
Yeah.
It's like, how about we actually look at a real solution to what we're doing, but that's not what they're doing at all.
I know.
So what's number three?
There's a third criterion. Is that there is an adequate supply to support a mandate. You know, the worst thing they could do is make it mandatory, and then they don't have enough for every group that is mandated for.
Oh, I'm sure that won't be a problem.
Right.
I'm pretty sure they've been ramping that up already.
Right. So they anticipate that the global demand will outstrip the supply. So then it'll create this salient question, not who must get the vaccine, but who will be granted access to the vaccines. So they really want to have a great supply ready before any mandate is even put into effect.
Well, you know what the perfect solution to that is? Make it voluntary. Because then whoever wants it can get it. And there will be that excess and leftover for some that don't want it in this country to be able to go to another country where people want it. And they're choosing to get it.
Right. Or we can just make millions and millions of doses of the vaccine before it's ever approved and before it's ever safety tested.
Just force it on everybody.
So when it is safety tested, we'll have all the vaccine we needed. Right? that would be another approach, and we're going to talk more about that later. So what is the fourth criterion?
You don't have your
paper underlined, do you?
I don't, but I have the fourth. The fourth is that there is transparent communication of the best evidence about the vaccine's safety and efficacy. Of course.
Right, transparency.
Yeah, transparency about the info. But, you know, I mean, the whole purpose of our podcast, or a big portion of what we do with this podcast, is acknowledge that what the official stance is on vaccine safety and efficacy is not the same thing as what really exists with vaccine safety and efficacy data. So transparency is something that our agencies have not been good at. And so the fact that they're going to ask for transparency, they'll check that box so quickly. Oh, yeah, we've got transparency. We put those three studies up on the CDC website. It's safe and effective, just like anything else.
Yeah.
And the truth that we understand, even in a situation where the vaccine's been tested for 15 years, not rushed over a couple months, even in those situations, they hide a lot of the safety data. They're not transparent with it. And we see anecdotally, all these people are being having adverse reactions and effects and injuries. And that's an anecdote, so it doesn't really count to them, but we see it so frequently, we're basically knowing that that's part of the evidence, and it's not something that they're making well known to people. And I can't imagine they will stop this machine that's in motion. This is a machine. In fact, what does it say in the very first line? It basically says that there is perhaps no scientific breakthrough that is more eagerly anticipated. Like, really? Really? How about a cure for cancer? I mean, I think that'd be a little bit more anticipated than this dumb thing, because, I mean, we're just talking about the COVID vaccine. This is not, you know, killing 800,000 people a year or 700,000 people a year like cancer does just in the United States. So there's so much pressure behind this effort.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That they're not going to stop if any of these criteria aren't met.
Right.
They're not going to be like, oh, we don't have full transparency. I'm sorry, we can't do it.
Right. Well,
there's no way.
But what they consider safety and efficacy is very, very different than what many people who make informed consent decisions
and
for their
brains.
Children and have brains.
And have a brain.
So to them, efficacy is one thing and one thing only, that the vaccine generates measurable antibodies in your immune system. They don't test whether or not those antibodies even work. They don't test the vaccine
in
real life.
Wait, explain that, because I think people don't know that. And the presence of antibodies does not equal necessarily the ability for your body to stop a reinfection or a subsequent infection when you're exposed to it.
So right. So all they need to say it's effective is they give a bunch of people the shot, they draw their blood, you know, 4 weeks later, and they have, you know, measurable anti-COVID antibodies in their bloodstream. That's all they measure. Whereas in real life, the way you would figure out if a vaccine works is you would give it to a bunch of people. And this also might be where animal research could have come into play that they've skipped, is give it to a bunch of animals and then expose them to the disease and see if they catch the disease.
Right, which makes more sense.
Yeah, but also study it in human populations. Say, yeah, we're going to give the vaccine to, you know, everyone in this city or everyone in this large medical organization or medical group, and study the rates of disease, you know, in real life for those people. That kind of real efficacy studies take time. And I don't think they're going to be transparent about the distinction between the two. All they're going to care about is, yes, we have detectable antibodies. We're going to assume those antibodies work and that they're effective. And that's what they're going to call efficacy. And then when it comes to safety, they're safety data that they're going to be transparent about is basically everyone who got the vaccine, half of them got fever, a quarter of them got achy, some of them had flu-like symptoms, some of them, you know, got swelling at the injection site, and, you know, 1% of them, you know, went to the emergency room because they felt super sick, and that's the safety data. Well, that's not safety data, that's side effect data. That's them collecting data on what all the side effects are. Mm-hmm. If you're going to claim you have safety data on something, that means you've given the vaccine to a whole bunch of people and monitored them and scrutinized them and studied them, and then you've not given the vaccine to a whole bunch of people as a placebo group and see how their health goes over a few months or a year. Then you compare the two. That would be what's called safety data. They're not going to have any data like that. So they're basically going to have antibody levels for efficacy, and they're going to have side effect data, but they won't really have any true safety data. Oh, sorry, Siri. Siri's answering
that's
me.
That's funny. His phone, just Siri on his phone, just started to answer the question. Where is the safety data for vaccine, Siri? I'm sorry, I could not find any.
Oh, she says, see the CDC website.
Did she?
For all coronavirus. No, she didn't. okay, so
she's like, that's misinformation. Dr. Bob Sears, you're censored.
So they say the importance of transparency with safety and efficacy data is very important, particularly given the possibility that the evidence underlying FDA approval for this vaccine may be more modest than usual, meaning they're going to have much less evidence showing this vaccine is safe and effective for the FDA to scrutinize, for the FDA to evaluate, than usual. They're not going to have very much evidence for the FDA to look at. And they're saying that's why it's even more important to be transparent. But how is that going to increase people's trust in the vaccine? It's not, when they see how little safety data they have. But I think they're just trying to be honest here. And once everyone feels like, oh, we're being honest and transparent, that everyone will feel better about the vaccine. And I'm not sure that they will.
Well, but again, they use the word transparency as if you think they're being completely honest. Right. And they're only showing you what they want to show you. So they're not going to shoot themselves in the foot here. Right. So it doesn't mean you're going to get access to everything. You're going to get access to what they want to show you. And that's very different. That's not actually transparency. But yeah, the fifth thing, basically talking about adverse events and a compensation program for those who are injured. And, you know, I mean, I'd have to say that the average American does not even know that there is a compensation program for injuries for other vaccines.
Right.
The average American does not know that we have a federal vaccine court, that pharmaceutical companies have no liability if your child if your child is injured. I think that the idea that people do get injured from vaccines, and the federal government knows that, so they've actually created a full-on court and compensation program for this, and that they've paid out the $4 billion to people with injuries. I think most people are completely in the dark about that.
Right.
And if they knew that, just like you talked about, smallpox had a compensation program. Once you're making something mandatory, once you're taking away liability from pharmaceutical companies, you have to create some type of accountability. But the problem is, these compensation programs don't really provide incentive for manufacturers to do better.
Right.
Because they're not the ones that are accountable.
Exactly.
So this all looks, you know, fine and dandy, like, oh, awesome. Well, at least they're going to have a compensation program, because then I feel safe knowing that if something goes wrong, you know, whatever. But the first thing I would think is, wait, why do you need a compensation program?
I know, totally.
How many people are going to get serious side effects? Like, it's almost like they already know that. And again, you take this back to the actual disease and you go, is it worth taking that risk that I might have serious side effects that would need to be compensated by the federal government because it was mandated, even though the virus itself would have just come and gone through me and I would have probably been completely fine? That's where you have to take that cost-benefit analysis every time for every vaccine.
Right.
And having a compensation program, that scares me as a consumer.
Yeah.
The fact that that's there, that means, oh, they're already anticipating problems.
Right.
They had problems with the swine flu in the 70s, remember? They had problems with that and people getting injured. And I mean, some of these things, this is not new, but most people don't really know. And now they're already factoring this into to the program because I feel like they're already expecting this is going to be potentially dangerous.
Yeah, and I find it surprising that everyone in mainstream, you know, medical policy making positions for vaccines, they all feel that if you have a compensation program, that it increases vaccine uptake and it increases trust in the vaccine program. Because people feel like, okay, I'll get the vaccine, but if I'm horribly injured, at least I can get compensated. Whereas I feel like you just said, the fact that they need a compensation program.
The fact that I can be horribly injured.
Right. I mean, you're right. I wouldn't be like, okay, you know, if I can be horribly injured, well, that's fine. At least I'll get a lot of money for it. It'd be like, no, you know, if I can be horribly injured, you know, what the heck?
That would be last ditch.
Right.
Like, this disease is so incredibly dangerous that I will probably die if I get it. So I'd rather be horribly injured than die. And so I'll pick option B, right? I mean, like, if option A is getting the virus versus option B taking the vaccine and having a potential risk of a side effect, you really have to look at, is this disease, I mean, we already know the answer, but is this disease so scary and so risky and so dangerous that it's worth you having a horrible side effect that you would need to be compensated for because you'll need care the rest of your life? Like, I would maybe do that if it was something so severe and so serious. But I don't think this has proven that, like I said, for anybody under 50, even up to 60, if you're relatively healthy, this is not going to kill you. But you have a guaranteed chance of a percentage of a side effect, you know, possibility with a vaccine.
Right.
That's guaranteed.
Right.
You don't necessarily have a guaranteed chance of severe complications with something like COVID in the healthy groups, which is the majority of our country.
Yeah.
That's the majority of the country.
Yep. Yeah. So the last criterion is that that they only impose mandates after they've tried making the vaccine voluntary, and that you need to go through a period of, you know, of people volunteering for the vaccine. Say you want to, you know, all healthcare workers volunteer for it, and you know, everyone who's elderly volunteers for it. And if enough people volunteer for it, then a mandate wouldn't be needed. And if that fails, which it will. It will, because we know only about half of people in those, you know, in those positions are going to get
the vaccine.
It wouldn't
matter if 94% of people did it. They would want 95. And if they had 90, it's just like a child. Yeah. Yeah. You give them 3 cookies, they want 4. You give them 2 bedtime stories, they want 3. Yeah. It's the same thing. If they had 95% compliance, they would go after that last 5%.
Right. But they say they're only, you should only give people a few weeks to see if a voluntary program works before they mandate it. Because they say the costs of a failed voluntary scheme are so high that the attempts to see a voluntary, you know, programs work should be limited to a matter of weeks.
And this is what I thought was really interesting. They said, so this is a quote, although state vaccination mandates are usually tied to school and daycare. And that just, gosh, that makes me upset. I get angry because it's like they have chosen to go that route because it's the easiest to get compliance. They know you have to have your kids in school. They know very well that if they want to get mandatory vaccination happening, they have to do it through school-aged children. And this is probably why Bill Gates says he wants to get the COVID vaccine on the newborn immunization schedule. It's like these types of things are so routine, and you just take your kid in and they get a handful of things. You don't even know what they're getting. And the doctor just does whatever the ACIP is telling him to do, which is the CDC recommendation. It's not technically mandatory, but most parents don't even question it. So just adding another dose, what's that going to do, right? Even though newborns aren't really, I mean, babies and children aren't really at risk of COVID complications, but why not just add it to the schedule? So they say, although state vaccination mandates are usually tied to school and daycare, and that, gosh, again, it just makes me so mad because parents need to work. So their kids need to go into daycare, and they need to go to school to get an education. So what do? They take advantage of that need. They take advantage of the fact that you as a parent or a single parent need to do that, and you'll be so pressured, you'll just go along with it because you can't really fight it because there aren't really options for you. And they know that, and I hate that because this disease does not negatively affect children. So there would be no reason to do that. And I think that's why they go against that. So they say usually these vaccination mandates are tied to school, but they said that approach is not appropriate for this virus because children are not a high priority group. Right. So at least they acknowledge the fact that children are not a huge risk at risk group. And so it wouldn't make sense to make that mandatory. Now, that's not to say it won't be, because again, I feel like that's always worked for them in the past. So what they say, though, is they really haven't been, nobody's really been taking the time to structure mandates around adults yet. And so a lot of people in the medical freedom movement and vaccine safety movement have been talking about adult mandates coming down the pipeline basically for a really long time. We've been talking about adult mandates are next. And when you do adult mandates, you got a much larger population than just the group of school children. And most adults are not really willing to be forced vaccinated with a bunch of things, even though they're somehow okay with it for their children without questioning,
Right.
So this whole thing at the beginning, they set the premise of, you know, we need to look at this more like an adult mandate, not so much a child mandate like they've done and had success with in the past. And it says, basically, they don't want to structure this like a compulsory vaccination program, but they want to make it where you have a penalty for non-compliance.
Right.
And like I said earlier on, it's the same thing. To me, it's the same thing. Whether you force me to do it by telling me to do it and saying it's forced, or whether you tell me my kid can't go to school and I can't go to work, or I can't travel, or whatever it is, that's still forcing me because you're not actually giving me an alternative. You're not giving me an option. You're taking me out of the right to society, which, again, some people might say, well, that's what you deserve, right? Okay, well, you know, talk to me when we've got a virus or bacteria that is so, so deadly that every single person opting out of that vaccine is putting somebody else at risk. This isn't that scenario. So to go this far to me is just absolute overreach.
Right. Plus, we don't even know yet if the vaccine will keep people from catching the disease and spreading it to others. So far, you know, all we know is the vaccine, if it's going to work, according to how traditional vaccines work, it'll just make it so you are less likely to have severe complications from the disease. But you very well might be just as likely to get sick with the illness and be symptomatic and be contagious to others. whether or not you're vaccinated with this vaccine, that there might not actually be any public health benefit from that, from this vaccine, and that has yet to be determined.
Well, you know what my theory is? My theory is they are going to weaken the vaccine as to not cause too many side effects, because the microscope is on this vaccine and everybody getting it right at this point. And because the animal trials were so detrimental in the first SARS-CoV-1 studies, where we've had animals that were getting the vaccine and later made them more susceptible to the disease and dying from it. Nice. So when you have that kind of poor safety risk profile, I have a feeling that this would be highly reactive. They have not had success in the past with a coronavirus vaccine. So I kind of feel like, this is just my theory, that they're going to weaken the vaccine. Everybody's still going to get it, though, so they're still getting the money for it. But it's not going to actually stop the spread, because it's going to be weakened. And what they're going to do as it continues to spread through the population is they're going to blame it on the people who are opting out of the vaccine. Jeez. Do you see how they could do that? Yeah. Oh, it's still spreading. People aren't wearing their masks. That's why. It's those people not wearing their masks. Oh, only 80% got the vaccine. It's those 20. If only those other 20%, then we could have been done with this by now. Yeah. How many times have you heard people say, if people would have just stayed home those first 2 weeks, then this would have all been over.
Yeah.
If people would just wear their masks, it would all be over by now. Yeah. Not understanding that's not how it works.
Right.
And so you can get a bunch of people taking a vaccine, not have it be very effective, and nobody really has to know, and it's going to still spread. And what are they going to do? Blame it on the people who aren't getting it, socially pressure those people, put the judgment and have a hate attack. PR campaign against the people who are refusing or opting out for medical reasons and doing exactly what they do in the regular vaccine debate, while the disease and the illness continues to spread through society, and they blame it on not having enough people choosing the vaccine. It would have been over by now. That's my theory of what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, they do sort of say something that where they pretend to be on our side a little bit when it comes to punishments and penalties for not taking the vaccine. They suggest employment suspension or stay-at-home orders for people in high-priority groups who refuse vaccination. They actually say that we should not fine people, and there should be no criminal penalties for those who don't comply, because fines disadvantage people who are poor, and criminal penalties create all kinds of legal challenges, and they feel that if we did either of those, that would be bad public health policy, because it would increase distrust in the vaccine. So they're kind of like not taking a really hard line approach on this. But again, that might be them sort of like pretending to be on our side, trying to pretend on the side of, you know, the public, and
that's
protecting
like
us from government overreach.
Right. But that's kind of like when they kind of came out going, we're not going to call them anti-vaxxers anymore. We're going to call them vaccine hesitant, because we want to have a nice, cheerful
conversation
with them to get them to see the true risk. We don't want them to feel like they're being attacked. Right. And you know that really this is just a ploy. But I got scared by the HPV recommendation here when they are the association. They basically said that we need to do this kind of mandate a certain way. And what they said was the HPV vaccination mandate had vaccine manufacturers involved. It had the vaccine manufacturer involved in the crafting and the lobbying for the mandate legislation, which, do not lie, people, okay? The people writing this, do not lie. That happens for all of them. That happens for all of them. We know damn well that the pharmaceutical lobbyists are the ones that are crafting the legislation that the Democratic policymakers in individual states are creating to push mandatory vaccine legislation to take away the right for opting out, take away the right for exemptions. Let's be completely clear about that. It is not even close to the realm of possibility that pharmaceutical industry is not 100% involved in that.
Right.
And so they admit it here, though, with the HPV vaccine, and they say because there was manufacturer involvement, basically what it did was it raised suspicion. Suspicion on the part of the public. And it basically said the public was thinking this was about profit rather than public health. Oh my gosh, can you imagine? Now that's a novel. That's a novel concept, not a novel coronavirus.
Right,
that's a novel concept. We're very aware of that happening. And people that try to say, oh no, they're doing this for, you know, goodwill. This is not about profit. Right. We've shown that that's not true. This is a business just like anything else. And if you really believed in your product, you wouldn't have to mandate it. If your product really did what it said it did, you wouldn't have to mandate it. So what they're saying is don't get the vaccine manufacturers involved in this, though, when we talk about this mandatory legislation, because that could get the public suspicious that there is profit motives behind this, and this is nothing to do with public health, and it says it will undercut the actual support for vaccination. It'll eventually get people to do less and less. And I kind of feel like that's what goes on with the flu shot. I feel like it's so forced down your throat with every ad, every sign, every commercial. It's so like desperate. It's so desperate that it makes you want to go away from it. You know, just for the fact that they push it on you so hard. And anytime they mandate, it really makes you question things and kind of go, wait a second, why are they forcing this on me? Why are they forcing this on my child? I think in our experience, a lot of families have joined the medical freedom, health freedom movements every single time a new bill comes around because mm-hmm. they're aware that they're trying to stifle your parental rights or your freedom or your medical freedom and the relationship between you and your doctor. And so when they do that, everybody kind of goes, huh? What's that about?
Yeah.
And then it makes you question more things, right?
Yeah, but the pharmaceutical industry's influence on these flu vaccine promotion programs, and if they're going to be involved in promoting the COVID vaccine, their involvement is sometimes hidden.
Oh yeah,
because
for
when
sure.
it comes to flu shot promotion, the flu manufacturers themselves, they are barely publicly involved in that promotion.
Right. Oh, yeah.
They basically funnel tons of money into medical centers, hospitals, drug stores, Costco. I mean, everywhere. They funnel tons of advertising money into those organizations. Mm-hmm. So they let the medical establishments do the promoting for them.
Of course.
And so the public trusts it. Right. But financially, it's all backed by the pharmaceutical companies. So the same thing is going to happen here. I mean, these authors are saying, we have to be careful to make sure this doesn't happen, that the public does not perceive that the manufacturers are involved in these, mandate programs. So they're going to have to try to, in the public's eye, separate themselves.
So they'll just be sneakier.
But, they're going to be funding part of that. And we know they're going to be profiting from it. But it's kind of fascinating how they highlight how this really hurt HPV vaccine uptake when the public found out that that the HPV manufacturers were so heavily and openly involved with the lobbying efforts. And so it's at least they're aware of that. I think it's interesting. But they're going to be behind. Oh yeah, one thing I wanted to say is probably one of the number one ways that pharma is behind medical legislation is through state medical organizations. Like in California, we have the CMA, the California Medical Association. Every state has a state medical association. And this is where like every doctor in the state signs up and pays dues to this organization, if you want to. And that organization uses all that money and tons of pharma grants and pharma donation money to put forth medical lobbying efforts. And so all the lawmakers think that these medical organizations are all representing doctors, and that they're all teams of doctors coming to their state capital saying, all the doctors in our state have gathered together, and this is what we think is the best decision for our state, and we're all doctors deciding this. What people need to realize is your average doctor in any state is not involved at all in that state's medical association. The number of doctors actually actively involved is tiny. These state medical associations are pharma-funded lobbying groups, political lobbying groups. It's almost like they're a PAC, mm-hmm. right? And they pretend to represent doctors because legally they have tens of thousands of doctors signed up on their roster as being members. But in reality, they're just putting forth, mandated medical laws that are pharma funded. So that's how they kind of get around this. And that's how they keep the public from realizing that this is all pharma funded, is it all seems to be driven and funded by the medical associations, where in reality they're not. So
I concur.
Yes. All right.
I think we should end this episode here. Okay. And so we'll end our Facebook Live here. All right. And then we're going to maybe go on to talk about something else.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
Or yeah, or maybe not. Yeah, because I do have this super interesting secret email that I looked at and that talked a lot about, what's it called? The Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed.
I posted about that. You remember like a week or so ago?
Yeah, yeah,
which
yeah,
is what
yeah.
the CDC director, Robert Redfield's calling this whole, like, let's yeah. get a vaccine by January.
Yeah, so we got an inside look at Operation Warp Speed, and we're going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about that just for the podcast version of this episode. It might be on this episode, or it might be its own episode.
So
we'll see.
This is the Vaccine Conversation podcast. Mm-hmm. So if you do not subscribe already, and maybe you're somebody who's followed me for other reasons, and now you're seeing this kind of discussion going, wait a second, I'm not really against vaccines. Like, I don't know if I want to be part of this. I was just following you because of the conservative, like, political stuff. What we talk about on this podcast is all very data-based, it's evidence-based, the same way that I do with my posting. This is not an opinion. This is not an extremist viewpoint. We're literally bringing actual data and evidence that it just completely mirrors what we're seeing with the coronavirus situation, with the data manipulation, our regulatory agencies basically lying about things and about this partisan policymaking across the board that is really changing the way we do things and taking away rights and things like that. So this is very, very similar. So I urge you to consider listening if you haven't already. And you'll get an idea of the facts behind what we share and understand that this is not just some foo-foo conspiracy theory, anti-vaxxer stuff. It's really not. And I know that this is a hot-button topic, and I know it's taboo, and I know there are certain people that just won't even touch it. They're like, I don't want anything to do with vaccines. But I encourage you to look at it anyway. Take a couple episodes. See if you see something that catches your interest. We have 110 episodes. This is 111. Mm-hmm. And see if there's something interesting there. And I guarantee you we'll find you'll find information there that we've given you that is going to be stuff you haven't heard before, because that's the entire purpose of what we do and what I like to do privately on my own as well. So if you've not really followed the vaccine discussion and this makes you uncomfortable just even talking about it, I encourage you to get out of that comfort zone and go check out some of these episodes. It's on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, all these different places. And then I have my sidecast called What They Aren't Telling You, which briefly touches on the vaccine. It touches definitely on coronavirus as well as other social and political issues, but always the unpopular opinion, but it's evidence-based and data-based, which is what mm-hmm. I really like bringing to the table. So we're going to sign off for this episode. Thank you guys for spontaneously joining us for really, this is like one of our first Facebook Live, the whole time audio that was not meant to be a Facebook Live Q&A. It was just, we're just doing a video version of what we already do. And we might do this a little bit more often if you guys like this and this allows you to hear this conversation a little differently if you're not totally an audio person and you kind of like the visual. So
no,
maybe
I like being able to say things that I know we can edit out later. So
we don't really, I mean, that's the thing, though. We don't really edit that podcast at all. Yeah. But anyway, so join us again on iTunes, the Vaccine Conversation Podcast. Mm-hmm. And we have our website if you just want information and sources and things like that, which is immunityed.org. You can find a lot of stuff there. We did several years worth of posting there for content before we even started the podcast. So we haven't put a ton of new content because of the podcast, but we have all the source links and stuff for the stuff that we talk about that he so graciously updates on that website, as well as our Facebook group for Immunity Education Group.
Yep. You'll see this article that we talked today. You'll see a link to that article. And you can also just, there's this thing called Google. So if you put in ensuring uptake of vaccines against SARS-CoV-2, New England Journal of Medicine. You'll find the article.
All right, perfect. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you next time.
See you guys later.
On
the Vaccine
Conversation.
Here you go.
Okay, bye.
The information in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as medical advice. Always consult your healthcare professional for information on vaccines and infectious diseases.